This is VOA News. I'm Michael Brown. A senior ECOWAS official told West African Army generals that the bloc is ready to intervene militarily in Niger if a coup there is not reversed. Reuters correspondent Edward Barron reports.
Commissioner for Political Affairs, Peace and Security, Abdel Fattah Moussa, said the valiant forces of West Africa are ready to answer the call of duty. That was as he addressed army generals from member states who were meeting in Ghana. Military officers in Niger deposed President Mohamed Bazoum on July 26. They've defied calls from the United Nations, ECOWAS and Western powers to reinstate him. That prompted West African heads of state to order a standby force to be assembled. Moussa listed past ECOWAS deployments in Gambia, Liberia and elsewhere as examples of readiness. He also accused the junta of playing cat and mouse with the bloc. The junta has said it's open to talks to resolve the crisis.
Edward Byron reporting. The head of the Maui Emergency Management Agency, who has been heavily criticized for not activating disaster sirens during last week's wildfire response, resigned, citing health reasons. VOA's Diane Roberts has more.
Herman Ndaya has been under fire for not activating disaster sirens during last week's wildfire response. Maui's mayor accepted Ndaya's resignation, the county of Maui announced on Facebook. As the wildfire death toll rose to 111 on Wednesday, Ndaya defended not sounding sirens as flames raged. He said he was afraid the sirens would have prompted people to flee into mountains or inland where fires were burning. Hawaii has what it touts as the largest system of outdoor alert sirens in the world. Diane Roberts, VOA News.
And for more news, please join us at voanews.com. This is VOA News. Meantime, the Maui fires incinerated the historic community of Lahaina and killed more than 100 people. President Joe Biden is set to arrive in Maui on Monday. Analysts say regional countries are facing a crisis of legitimacy as they run out of options and time to restore democratic rule in Niger after soldiers ousted the president last month. AP correspondent Charles de la Desma has more on the story. We're going to have that for you coming up in our next hour. Meantime, Belarus. In Belarus, China's defense minister promises to boost cooperation with Russian ally Belarus. We get more on that story from the AP's Lisa Dwyer.
Chinese Defense Minister Li Shangfu has visited Belarus and said China would increase military cooperation with Russia's neighbor, where Moscow is deploying tactical nuclear weapons. Neither side gave details of what the cooperation will entail, but the two countries have agreed to hold joint military exercises next year. Li visited Russia just before going to Belarus. Russian troops that were previously deployed in Belarus were part of Russia's invading force in Ukraine, and Russian troops and weapons still remain there. China claims to be neutral in the conflict in Ukraine, but accuses the United States and its allies of provoking Russia and maintains strong economic, diplomatic, and trade ties with Moscow. I'm Lisa Dwyer.
Taiwanese Vice President William Lai returned on Friday from a sensitive visit here to the U.S., saying he had showed the island self-confidence venturing into the international community. China claims Taiwan as its territory and denounced the transit stops in the U.S., calling Lai a separatist and a troublemaker. Lai officially only made transits into the U.S., first in New York and then San Francisco, on his way to and from Paraguay to attend the new president's inauguration in one of only 13 countries that maintains formal ties with Taipei. And the UN rights chief says North Korea is increasing its repression of human rights and people are becoming more desperate and reportedly starving in parts of the country as the economic situation worsens there. Former U.S. President Donald Trump now says he won't be holding a press conference next week to unveil what he claims is new evidence of fraud in the 2020 election in Georgia, citing the advice of lawyers. Trump had announced he would be holding the event after a grand jury voted to charge him and 18 others for alleged conspiracy to overturn the election results. I'm Michael Brown, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Friday, August 18, and here are some of the stories we are covering. ECOWAS military chiefs map out strategies to activate a standby force in Niger.
If presidential guards in Guinea and Niger take hostage their president, nobody in West Africa is safe. That is why I urge you to continue to be loyal to ECOWAS directly.
Senegal's Sonko sends a message from his hospital bed about Niger's coup and ECOWAS' threat of military intervention. Northern South Sudan's economy is decimated by the conflict in neighboring Sudan. Malawi moves to end recurring fuel shortages. Zimbabwe's only female presidential candidate explains why she's running.
I have been watching as the government over the past several years has essentially been opening the doors to exploitation of our natural resources, and we're not seeing a translation of that to the people. If anything, it's getting worse, and we need to put an end to the problem.
And Namibia is to get 58% of its oil revenues. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Military chiefs from West Africa gather in Ghana on Thursday to map out strategies to deploy a standby force in Niger, if possible, to restore constitutional order. Ken Mensah was at the meeting and reports from the Ghanaian capital, Accra.
Two-day meeting was called after leaders of regional bloc ECOWAS last week approved the deployment of the standby force to reinstate deposed Nigerian president Mohamed Bazoum. The military junta in Niamey, which took power on July 26, is under pressure from world leaders to restore the democratically elected Bazoum. Before agreeing to talks with the bloc last week, the junta defied a one-week ultimatum by West African leaders to surrender and refused entry to a joint ECOWAS, African Union and UN delegation. Nigeria's top military leader, General Christopher Gwabin Musa, spoke to the news media before entering into a closed-door session. Musa, who also serves as the president of the Committee of Chiefs of Defense Staff in West Africa, said they are poised to help restore constitutional rule in Niger.
We know democracy is what we stand for, democracy is what we encourage, and democracy is what is good. The coup d'etat in the Republic of Niger has been a source of great concern, not just for the ECOWAS, but for all who believe in the ideas of democracy, stability, and the rule of law.
Niger has closed its borders with ECOWAS countries and shut its airspace as a precautionary measure against possible external threats. The development has led to a cut in the supply of medicine and food, hampering UN humanitarian operations, among many others. For his part, Ghanaian Defense Minister Dominic Nitiwu did not mince words while admonishing soldiers in the region to respect constitutional rule. He said the meeting is a strong indication that bloc leaders will resort to military intervention to resolve Niger's political situation if other measures fail.
If presidential guards in Guinea and Niger take hostage their president, nobody in West Africa is safe. That is why I urge you to continue to be loyal to your heads of state. I urge you to continue to be loyal to ECOWAS directives and to give effect that the days that coup d'etats enjoy the support of our people are over.
An international diplomatic consultant, Farouk Al-Wahab, told VOA that ECOWAS is just flexing its muscles because it does not have the human and financial resources to launch a military operation of such scale.
Military invasion, war, or operation cannot work in this regard. This will be an air battle. Togo has no air force. Sierra Leone has no air force. Liberia has no air force. Gambia has no air force. And then also Guinea-Bissau, no air force. It will be a meeting and a party as usual. There will be a declaration. There will be a talk show. Action can never follow today. Action not tomorrow.
Cape Verde has pulled out of any talks involving military intervention. Officials from nine countries, including Ivory Coast, Togo, Liberia, Senegal, and Gambia, are attending the meeting, which will end on Friday. Not present were officials from Mali, Guinea, Niger, and Burkina Faso, which have all been suspended from the bloc as a result of unconstitutional takeovers. Kent Mensah for VOA News, Accra.
In Senegal, a member of the opposition African Patriots of Senegal for Work, Ethics and Fraternity Pastel Party says the health of its leader, Ousmane Sonko, is deteriorating. Sonko has been on a hunger strike since July 30th at Dakar's main hospital to protest what he calls politically motivated charges against him. He is on the 24-hour police guard. Pastel member Nafisa Dia tells me that Sonko sent a message through his lawyers about the Niger coup and ECOWAS's threat of military intervention.
Actually, it was not him who issued it directly because he's not allowed to talk, but his lawyer went to see him and conveyed his message. He said that he was very surprised by the coup. His position is that he's for the principle of maintaining the constitutional order, and he's very sorry for the population of Niger. But even though he is condemning the procedure, this is unfortunate. He calls for a peaceful resolution of the situation because, you know, some ECOWAS countries, they had decided to send military there to try to bring back the constitutional order. But what Sonko said is that the Niger authorities, they refrained from any violence. And even during the seizure of the power by the presidential guard, there were no shots fired. No casualties were reported, and the president did not complain of any abuse or act against his dignity. So there's no need to use force there because it will bring only casualties.
Nafisa, so Mr. Sonko, is he still in the hospital, and what can you tell us about how he is doing?
Well, Mr. Sonko, Wednesday, August 16th, is his 18th day of privation from food and water, and his strength is visibly declining. He's still resilient, but you can see that after 18 days, we feel that his health is deteriorating, but he still keeps digging deep. We understand him because he's just exercising his natural right to demand respect for the inviolability of his intrinsic human dignity, his freedom.
So can he leave on his own if he wants to leave?
Leave what? Where the hospital?
Yeah, can he go home?
No. The police guard are still around him. He's still a prisoner. Even his family cannot visit him. His friends cannot visit him. Only sometimes his lawyer and one of his physicians, I believe, has the right to go and look at him.
Nafisa Dia is a member of Ousmane Sonko's Pastel Party. She was speaking with me from Moncton, Canada. The only female candidate in Zimbabwe's August 23rd election says she is concerned about the country's future. Elizabeth Valerio of the United Zimbabwe Alliance Party says successive politicians have failed to deliver a better life for Zimbabweans despite the country's enormous natural resources. Valerio tells me that she did not collaborate with the more established political parties because her prescription for solving Zimbabwe's problems is far different from what the other parties have been offering.
Very concerned about the future of Zimbabwe. I have been watching as the government over the past several years has essentially been, you know, opening the doors to exploitation of our natural resources. And we're not seeing a translation of that to the people. We're not seeing any change in terms of the quality of life for the Zimbabwean people. If anything, it's getting worse. And we need to put an end to the problems. That's why I'm running for president.
Now, on the campaign trail, how are the Zimbabwe people accepting your message?
It's been very encouraging because wherever I'm going, first of all, a lot of people do not even know that I'm running for president. The Zimbabwe Electoral Commission hasn't even broadly announced that there is a female presidential candidate or that there is an additional presidential candidate, you know, since there was approval for me to be added to the ballot. So it's been really challenging for me because we've got to reach as many citizens in a very short period of time. But when we do get in front of the voters, they are excited. I've had such an amazing response. People have been waiting and yearning for something different, something that truly can bring change to Zimbabwe. Because if you look at all of the other political candidates, essentially they've been in the political scene for an extended period of time. These are not new faces. They're not bringing anything different or new to Zimbabwe. Whereas when we come and bring this good news that we have a new political party that has very different ideologies and different, you know, objectives in terms of our manifesto, it's like a breath of fresh air for Zimbabwe. Our biggest challenge is that over the years, people have become more and more desperate. They only see their immediate needs, and they're expecting, you know, overnight for you to be able to solve their problems. But as we start to have conversations, people are really embracing us in a big way. We're very optimistic about this election.
As you said, you are the only female candidate. Is that right?
That is correct. I'm the only female candidate that made it onto the ballot.
I'm wondering, why did you not join with the other established political parties?
Yeah, so first of all, I did not seek out politics. I didn't pursue this. What I was trying to do was find a solution for the problems we're facing in Zimbabwe. But sitting in a meeting, the very first meeting we had for our political party, everyone had the same thing to say. These parties are not bringing any solutions to Zimbabwe. They are not honoring their promises. When they go to elections, they say a lot of things, but you don't actually see that materializing. And so everyone sitting around the table was saying, we need something very different, something that will actually deliver solutions for Zimbabwe. And so they elected me president. We wanted a political party that will bring Zimbabwe forward. There was a lot that we did not identify with in the other political parties. And there was really no thought about joining anyone else because what we wanted for Zimbabwe was very different from what they had been able to deliver.
Madam, thank you so much and congratulations again. I wish you all the best on your campaign trip.
I really appreciate it. And I'm glad that we were able to speak. Thank you so much for your time as well.
Elizabeth Valerio is the only female presidential candidate in Zimbabwe's August 23rd elections. She was speaking with us from the capital, Harare. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, August 18. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And still to come on our program, Samson O'Malley Sports. Sudan's conflict has caused prices in the border region of neighboring South Sudan to rise sharply, according to local market traders. Meanwhile, the production and export of South Sudan's oil through Sudan, which the World Bank says makes up 90% of the country's revenue, is being strangled by the conflict too. Henry Wilkins reports from Renk, South Sudan.
Johanna Bill is a market trader in the town of Renk, close to South Sudan's border with Sudan. He says that since Sudan's war started in April, goods have been scarce and more expensive in the north of his country. He says the challenges are becoming worse, particularly in the northern region. The lack of goods coming from Sudan is hampering his ability to keep up with demand, although there are occasions when he is able to buy goods from Sudan. South Sudan lacks a functioning road network, and the north of the country is poorly connected to the capital, Juba. One expert explains. Peter Biar Ajak is a Sudan expert at Harvard University.
The northern state in southern Sudan really relies on supplies that come from North Sudan. And because of the conflict, those supplies have been entirely cut off and abruptly also. Yeah, this is nothing that was foreseen. Now that economy is decimated, all the supplies there are decimated. People have been displaced, millions and millions and millions of people. So this is just like entirely a serious economic collapse.
Abuk Atem is one of the more than 170,000 people who have fled Sudan to South Sudan, mostly through Renk. She says they are feeling the effects of Renk's collapsing economy too. Sometimes people stay hungry during the daytime and have only one meal in the evening, she says, because they lack the money to buy food. Putting a further squeeze on the economy, the production and export of oil, which according to the World Bank accounts for 90% of South Sudan's revenue, has also been hit hard by the conflict. Trucks seen here that would normally transport chemicals and other supplies are backed up at the border. Patrick Heinisch is an economist with Helaba, a German commercial bank. Asked if access to the Red Sea, made possible only by passing through Sudan, is important, he replied,
yes, definitely. Port Sudan is a very important port supplying the country, but the South Sudanese authorities and the oil ministry, they said that they face difficulties importing chemicals that are used for oil extraction because the ports in Port Sudan, it is no longer functional, or at least it is no longer delivering goods.
Meanwhile, those fleeing Sudan's war continue to stream across the border, putting even more pressure on Renk's collapsing economy. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Renk, South Sudan.
Malawi has announced measures to end recurring fuel shortages, which started in 2021. Consumers are facing long and winding queues at pump stations, forcing many motorists to sleep in their vehicles while waiting to buy fuel. However, government authorities say measures are underway to restock depleted national fuel reserves. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
Malawi government authorities told at a revised press conference Wednesday that the problem is largely due to a shortage of foreign exchange to purchase enough fuel. Moses Kunkuyu is Malawi's Minister of Information.
The major challenges have been mainly that of forex, where Malawi is importing less than what we are consuming. As of now, what we are importing currently has been hovering around 41 million liters per month.
Kunkuyu also said another problem is the pump stations quickly run out of fuel once they are refilled, because many people buy in larger quantities in anticipation of another scarcity.
Someone who would go on a normal day to buy 5,000 kwacha worth of fuel today is looking for some 30,000-40,000 to fill the tank. So ordinarily they would need 1.7 million liters on daily basis, but because now people are buying because they are anticipating that we may run dry again.
Malawi started facing fuel shortages in 2021, though today the situation has currently escalated, pushing operators of public transportation vehicles and traders to almost double their prices. Kunkuyu said the Malawi government has secured a $50 million loan from the Arab Bank of Economic Development in Africa for restocking fuel reserves to ease recurring supply challenges. The government is also discussing with some suppliers a contract to supply fuel, for which they would be paid in Malawi's local currency. The government has also announced that it would now consider importing fuel by train via the Nagala railway line for speed increase of the quantity of fuel Malawi needs. Clement Kanyama is the chief executive officer for the National Oil Company of Malawi. He said the loan will help to refill the country's depleted fuel reserves by the end of September.
For a start, our target is to bring in as much as 20% of fuel from Nakala, because according to our numbers, Nakala is the shortest route.
In the meantime, the Malawi Energy Regulatory Authority has banned the use of buying fuel in jerrycans, except those with licenses to allow such purchases. For VOA Africa, I am Lamek Masina in Blantyre.
An estimated 250 million barrels of light crude oil found by global energy giants Shell and Qatar Energy have sparked interest in Namibia as an emerging oil producer. Thursday was the last day of a two-day oil and gas conference looking at leveraging oil and gas resources for inclusive development. Vitalio Angula reports from VHOC.
Namibia's petroleum commissioner at the country's Ministry of Mines and Energy, Maggie Shino, said recent oil finds will contribute significantly to Namibia's GDP, with much of the total earnings going directly into the country's treasury.
While we are still in the pre-production phase, what we are doing is that we are putting together effective petroleum revenue management legislation. We want to ensure that the yields and the economic value that's going to be generated by these discoveries should benefit the current and the future generations, and that should be enshrined in our laws.
Shino was speaking at a conference on oil development this week in Windhoek. Over 700 delegates, including 200 international visitors, attended the International Conference on Oil and Gas in Namibia's capital. The conference was aimed at designing a clear roadmap for Namibia's emerging petroleum industry. While tapping Namibia's oil resources is expected to boost the country's economy, there are concerns about how that fits into efforts to reduce carbon emissions, which have caused climate change. The world, through the Paris Agreement, has set an ambitious target of net zero carbon emissions by the year 2050 through the introduction of clean energy and synthetic fuels like green hydrogen. Franz Kalenga, the head of Sustainable Energies, at Namibia's Petroleum Corporation said Namibia's clean energy drive would offset carbon emissions from oil and gas, and the two commodities can coexist.
The Europeans have come up with a mechanism called the CBAM. What does CBAM mean? It means Carbon Border Adjustment Mechanism. This means that for clients in Europe to buy commodities in Africa, for example, they are going to charge you heavily based on the amount of carbon that commodity carries.
It was revealed at the conference that other countries such as India and China are introducing taxes for commodities that carry a large carbon footprint. Independent economist Robin Sherborne said Namibia should seek to add value through onshore oil storage and refinement to reap maximum benefits once production kicks off.
The government of Namibia is an active shareholder in these oil and gas developments. It has at least a 10% stake, and I'm not commenting on whether that is a good and bad thing, but certainly it's a shareholder wanting to maximize its return as a shareholder, as all shareholders do.
Oil currently trades at $80 a barrel. Although the price fluctuates according to supply and demand, the global appetite for oil means Namibia stands to gain significant cash inflow through taxes and royalties when production begins. For VOA Africa, I'm Vitalio Angula in Windhoek, Namibia.
It is time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports with basketball. Senegal closed the first phase of their FIBA Olympic pre-qualifying tournament campaign with a 74-71 win over Mali to advance to the semifinals as Group A winners. The Mamadou Gueye coach team will now take on whoever finishes second in Group B, which will be determined between Tunisia and Guinea on Friday. Mali, meanwhile, will go up against Group B winners Cameroon in the last four. In athletics, Tobias Musson, the world champion and world record holder in the 100 meters hurdles, was cleared to race at the World Championships after a case of missing drug tests. A disciplinary tribunal found that Amusson did not commit an anti-doping rule violation. Her provisional suspension was lifted with immediate effect, according to the Athletics Integrity Unit, which handles doping cases in track and field. The Nigerian champion had been provisionally suspended last month, while anti-doping authorities investigated a charge that she missed three drug tests in the 12-month span, which can trigger up to a 2-year suspension even if an athlete never fails a drug test. In football news, Africa's premier club competition, the CAF Champions League, officially gets underway this weekend with the first preliminary round of fixtures taking place across the continent. The first preliminary round marks the start to the most sought-after Africa Club Football Prize, with the second round being the last hurdle before the remaining 16 clubs are drawn into the group stages. On Friday, Algeria's CS Constantine play host to Etoile Sportive du Sahel of Tunisia, while KMKM SC welcomes St. George SC of Ethiopia in the two Friday afternoon fixtures. On Saturday, champions of the 1995 edition and 2013 silver medalist Orlando Pirates of South Africa will head to the Comoros to face Djabal FC in one of the headlines fixtures of the weekend, along with another exciting clash between Namibia's African Stars, who will be taking on Power Dynamos of Zambia on Saturday. And out to tennis, where world number 5 Ons Jabeur of Tunisia advanced to her first hard court quarterfinal since January after Duna Vekic retired due to a viral illness in the round of 16 at the Western and Southern Open. Jabeur was leading 5-2 in the first set when the match was suspended due to rain. During the stoppage, Vekic retired from the match and also withdrew from the doubles. Jabeur will now face either world number 2 Aryna Sabalenka or world number 14th seed Daria Kasatkina in the quarterfinals. The Tunisian is playing her first tournament since making the Wimbledon final last month. In motorsports, the African Rally Championships competition returns to Burundi this weekend after close to a 3-decade hiatus. Club Automobile du Burundi, the motorsports governing body, last hosted an ARC event in 1995. And that's it for this Friday's edition of Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a nice weekend. And that's it for this Friday, August 18th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I am James Barton, Washington, saying have a great weekend.